The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Purim, is the fourth of a 15-part series, From the Exile of the Ten Tribes to the Reign of Herod. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the merit and honor of Ilana Brucha, Moshe Jonathan, Tamar Miriam, Daniel Zachary, and Shmuel Eliezer Nussbaum.
Throughout the ages, some of the greatest writers and thinkers of the non-Jewish world have tried to capture in a short phrase or sentence the essence of the Jewish people. Theophrastus was a disciple and the named successor of Aristotle, called the Jews a nation of philosophers, a people that never cease to be occupied with divinity. Muhammad, the founder of Islam, called the Jews the people of the book. One particular quote that I find striking, the modern English writer of fiction, many of you are familiar with, Agatha Christie. She called the Jews in one of her novels the people that do not forget. It's quite apt for this whole series, of course, but it's also a very apt description of the Jews. And the idea of preserving memories of the past is something which is well known even to those Jews that are unfortunately very far removed from their Judaism. Everyone has an outline here. On the first page in paragraph A, you have the mitzvah of constantly remembering the incident of Amalek. Zochar es asher asu lecha Amalek, remember what Amalek did unto you. And that particular paragraph finishes, says, with lo tishkach, thou shalt not forget. But not just the bad, our enemies, are we told to remember, but our whole experience creating us as a people. We're required to remember the Exodus, we see in paragraph B, required to remember the whole vision of being at Mount Sinai. And according to the Ramban, this is one of the commandments, not to forget what transpired at Sinai. What's very odd is that of all the incidents that are recorded after the time of the Torah, probably the one that the greatest emphasis is placed on remembering is the story of Purim. It's something that's read year after year. As you said on page 2, Yom Ha'elam Nizkorim V'Nasim, these days should be remembered, is understood that the incident, the story of the Megillah, is read, and we read it not only one time by day, but an additional second time the night before. And not only were we required to recall the incident, but we were promised that it will never be forgotten. And in paragraph E, on page 2, I have a quote from the Rambam. Let me just read this to you in English. All the works of the prophets and all the holy writings are destined to be abolished, with the exception of Megillas Esther. In other words, in the time of Mashiach, all we will have will be the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, the original Torah, and Megillas Esther. It is as permanent as the five books of the Torah and the laws of the oral Torah that will never be abolished. That in terms of the recording of the event. And the Rambam continues, and even though all the commemorations of difficult times will cease, the days of Purim will not. As it is stated, and these days of Purim will not pass from the Jews, this commemoration will not cease from their seed. So there will always be a celebration of Purim. But despite the fact that we're required to remember it, to constantly celebrate it. But among secular historians, it is probably the one work which is recorded in the whole Bible and all of Tanakh, which is the least understood. I will not bother tonight to go through the details of the story itself. It's probably all very well known to all of you here. But I would like to go through various elements of the historical setting of that story. And that begins, and here's on page 2, and this is the second part, Achashverosh in the Beis HaMikdash, with understanding the link between the events of Purim and in the backdrop of all the events we've discussed in the previous lectures about the destruction of the temple and the beginning of the beginnings of the rebuilding of that temple. In the book of Ezra, dealing with the events that happened shortly after the first wave of return in the days of Cyrus of Koresh, there began a campaign launched by the non-Jews of the area and the Samaritans to discourage the rebuilding of the temple. And let me quote. Here, this is in paragraph A, part 2. In the reign of Achashverosh, and this is where Achashverosh is first mentioned, in the beginning of his reign, wrote they, in other words, referring to the enemies, unto him an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah, of Yehuda, and Yerushalayim. This is understood, it seems to be in the simple reading of the text, this Achashverosh followed Koresh. First Koresh is mentioned, and the sentence, the verse prior to this, is that the attempt was already in the times of Koresh, of Cyrus, to stop the building. The next sentence is, and in the reign of Achashverosh, they wrote unto an accusation against the inhabitants of Yehuda and Yerushalayim, which would seem to place Achashverosh, then historically, as a successor of Cyrus. The next sentence, and in the days of Artaxerxes, Artaxasta, and then we have a whole group of people. This is a great detail of who wrote. And it goes on in great detail to describe what that letter contained. And because they were successful in the reign of Artaxerxes, they ceased the work of the house of God, which is at Yerushalayim. So it ceased unto the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. And it would just seem from a simple reading that this Artaxerxes came before Darius. Just a simple reading would say that there was Cyrus, the one who initiated the building, and then there was Achashverosh, there was Artaxerxes, and then finally it began again in the reign of Darius. This is how traditionally these verses are understood. Perhaps at a later lecture, when we'll get to the, we will have a, we'll go in great detail into the secular understanding of the events of the day. we will have another interpretation of this verse. But the interpretation I'm saying is both a traditional interpretation and basically what flows in the words itself. In addition, important to note, and this is important to know, putting the what we call the secular history side by side with the traditional history. Artaxerxes is understood to be not the proper name of the king of Persia, but rather the royal name. Just as Paro, Pharaoh, was the royal name of the king of Egypt, not his own proper name. Each pharaoh had their own name. So too, Artaxerxes, Artaxasta, is understood, at least this is by the Talmudic tradition, as a generic name. In fact, the word Artaxasta means he who is fit to rule. It's a royal name. What is interesting, and we will point out later on, is why then, if Ahasuerus is one and the same as the Artaxerxes, and it flows that in the reign of Ahasuerus, we're dealing just with his name proper, there was a campaign to halt the building of the temple. And in the days of Artaxerxes is a continuation of that attempt. Why was the name changed? Either call him one or call him the other, or call them both in the same sentence. This is something we will deal with within this lecture. But here, really, this pasuk places Ahasuerus firmly, what we call, in history. Ahasuerus is placed in the era of when the temple was beginning to be built and stopped until when the temple finally was built. There's an 18 year period that within that 18 years is where Ahasuerus is placed in history, at least according to traditional sources. I'd like to turn to page 3. In this light, placing Ahasuerus not only in this interim period, but is really the person who is so concerned with the Jews that he halted the building of that temple. Chazal, the sages of the Talmud, paint a picture of Ahasuerus as a person who is very sensitive and very aware of the status of the Jews of his kingdom. As we said, this was the last lecture about the periods of 70 years. The kingdom of Babel, of Babylon, lasted for 70 years. The exile of the Jews under King Jehoiachin, from that period of time till the first wave of return was 70 years. And from the final destruction of the temple and the ultimate exile of the Jews to the building of that temple in a meaningful manner was, again, 70 years. So we have three periods of overlapping 70 years, and that was discussed last time. The number 70 was a number that was prophesied. It was a number that was well known. Belshazzar, the last king of the Babylonian Empire, was well aware of those 70 years. And in fact, when according to his calculations, those 70 years had passed, and there no longer was a Jewish problem, he made a whole feast, and he brought out the vessels of the temple. It was on that night when he made the feast that the writing on the wall, this disembodied hand, wrote the message that his kingdom was about to be toppled. And I'd like to read with you, this is on page 3 in English, the summary of the Gemara and Megillah that continues this story of Belshazzar. In the second verse of the Megillah, which is introduced, his Biyamimohem Kesheves HaMelech, when the king Ahasuerus was settled. And later, the next verse writes, Bishnas Sholosh L'Molcho, in the third year of his reign. It's not clear what does it mean, Kesheves HaMelech. Rava, in the Gemara Megillah, and the word Sheves does not mean physical settlement, but means psychological settlement. His mind was settled. Because he, Ahasuerus, felt that now the time, it was definitely clear that the Jews would no longer be redeemed. And it says, what does this mean? It's written at the end of 70 years of the reign of Babylon. It says, I will remember you. This was the prophecy of Yirmiyahu, of Jeremiah. And Daniel also made a similar prophecy. The I remember you, of course, is the first return. But at the end of 70 years from the destruction of Yerushalayim, I'll remember and rebuild it, refers ultimately to the ultimate building of the temple. Ahasuerus understood, though, that what the time that one counts, the 70 years, that count begins from the first exile of Yechoniah. And we'll read together here. It says, Balshatzar's Cheshbon, Balshatzar's 70 years, that he was certain they would not be resurrected, the Jews, was based on the following calculation. Balshatzar added up the 45 years of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, 23 years of Evel Merodach, that was Nebuchadnezzar's son, and his own, Balshatzar's first 2 years, which comes out to 70. 70 years had passed, nothing had happened to Yerushalayim, never be redeemed. Therefore, he took out the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash and used them. Ahasuerus said, however, that although Balshatzar erred, he says, I have not. Is it written 70 years from the beginning of the kingdom of Babylon? It is written from the reign of Babylon, meaning the reign over the Jews. In other words, the exile of the Jew, the first exile of the Jews to Babylon. So it says, how many years were missing? And there's, what's the difference? It says, 8. Now, his calculation was, well, then we have one of besides those original two, the next year of Belshazzar, 5 of Darius and Cyrus. This is the first Darius, not to be confused. There are two Dariuses. This is Darius the Mede from Modai, and Cyrus, who was his son-in-law. And 2 of his own, and Ahasuerus had another 2. So, that really is, according to his calculation, should be the years have already passed from the first exile. 70 years have passed. The attempt to build a temple had been foiled. There's no temple there. Everything is safe. And when he saw that, according to this new calculation, 70 years already passed, he said, now for sure they will never be redeemed. Thereupon, Ahasuerus took out the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash and used them. As we're going to see, the literature from the Gemara and the Talmud and from the Midrashim clearly see an Ahasuerus who is troubled with the Jewish problem. He is the one who stopped the building of the temple, is happy to see that Hashem is no longer involved in reconstructing Jewry. And his kesheves, his peace of mind, and his tremendous simcha is connected with his senses that finally Jewry has been vanquished. It's important to understand that even though the official reading, the reading that we have of the Megillah, which was sent out throughout all the kingdom, does not directly point a finger at Ahasuerus. He seems to have been duped by Haman.
The picture that the Gemara draws is one of Ahasuerus actively involved with Haman in contemplating the eventual destruction of the Jews. So he was no friend of the Jews. In addition, as you see in paragraph C on page 3, it says Ahasuerus and that party put on the big day kuna. He put on the robes, probably of the Kohen Gadol, ones that were well known for their beauty and ornamentation. He brought out the vessels on page 4 of the Beis Hamikdash. He brought the clay Beis Hamikdash. This is in the Medrash Esther Rabbah. This is brought in the Gemara. And in paragraph E, we find that the Medrash describing the outrage, that actually this simcha then was a simcha for the destruction of the temple. And this is, the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, and this sinner is making a celebration. Again, says we see that in the view, I just want to keep repeating this because it's important as we're going to see other views. In the views of Chazal, Ahasuerus, and in the time and the whole setting is this interim period. Vashti, who is eventually killed, the reason she is killed is, according to the Medrash, because of her role in stopping the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. And this is in paragraph F. Why did Hashem do it? To kill Vashti. Because she did not let Ahasuerus rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. She said to him, that which my forebears destroyed, Nebuchadnezzar destroyed, because Vashti was the great-granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. Says, you wish to rebuild it. Later on in his reign, Vashti had already been killed. He has a new wife. This is after Haman had already issued the letters that went far and wide throughout his domain to destroy the Jews. Esther is coming to plead on behalf of the Jews. She doesn't tell Ahasuerus originally what her plan is. And Ahasuerus comes and is very congenial. And he says, what is it that you want? He says, Ad chatzi hamalchus, up until half of the kingdom, I'm willing to give you. The Medrash points a hidden meaning in this verse. That Ad chatzi hamalchus, he didn't say chatzi hamalchus. He didn't say, I'm willing to give you half. Up until half. Means really up until the midpoint. I'm not willing to give you the midpoint of my kingdom. Ahasuerus looked at Yerushalayim, at the place of the Beis HaMikdash, as the center of his kingdom. Says that I'm not willing to give up. Says I want control over that area. And there was a hint, perhaps a Freudian slip, but there was a hint, and this is if you look in paragraph G. That even when he was talking to Esther about something totally unrelated, on the back of his mind there was this constant fear of the Jews. And there, ultimately, this is the Targum in Esther, because of his involvement in delaying the building of the Beis HaMikdash, says he was punished, that his life was shortened. In fact, according to the chronology of the Talmud, his reign was only some 14 years. The Purim story happened in the 12th year of his reign. I mean, he lived a very short time afterwards. And in fact, which is very interesting from a historical perspective, you see on page 5, in paragraph I, we find the Medrash from Vayikra Rabbah describes the Darius. This is not to be confused with the first Darius. But Darius, who built the second temple, was, according to the Medrash, the son of Esther. There's a problem historically with this Medrash. There's a problem from the Gemara as well, because from the Gemara it doesn't seem that they had children. Like there, Esther was careful not to have children from Ahasuerush. Rav Shimon Schwab maintains that the Medrash is a preservation of a tradition that Esther, though not perhaps the biological mother of Darius the Latter, but was the spiritual mother of that person and a profound influence upon him. And it was due to that influence that the temple was rebuilt. But again, the Medrash is stressing the fact that the players, in other words, Esther, who saved the Jews, which is would seem to be the main thrust of the story, was also the rebuilder of the temple indirectly. That is Ahasuerus' role. It's interesting also the picture the Midrashim paint of Mordechai's role in the rebuilding of the temple. This pasuk, as we say, this is on page 5, section 3, paragraph A. Asher Hogla Mirushalayim. This, we begin the story of Mordechai as is introduced in the Purim story. Mordechai was exiled with the exile that went with Yechoniah, the king of Yehuda, whom Nebuchadnezzar had exiled. We read this traditionally in the same tone that we read Eicha, the mournful tone. It would seem from the simple reading of this text that Mordechai is clearly put in the era, this interim era. As we said, from the time of the feast backwards, if we want, to the time of that exile of Yechoniah was some 70 years. Mordechai, who is pictured both, it would seem, from the Megillah itself and as a Midrashim, as a leader of the Jews, we picture as a man in his perhaps his 60s, 70s, 80s, not much older than that. The story Asher Hoglam Yerushalayim seems to say he himself was exiled, not his parents or grandparents, but Mordechai himself went with that exile. If we would put Mordechai historically and Ahasuerus historically in another era, after the temple was built, for instance, we'd have a terrible time with the dating of Mordechai. He seems then would be an extremely old man. As it is, or at least we're putting him as an elder statesman. So the little paragraph we have in the Megillah itself would indicate the dating of the Megillah, even though the Megillah itself does not have, within itself, has no clear indications of when it happened, other than it happened in Ahasuerus' reign. But this sentence seems clearly to indicate that it happened, as tradition has it, before the rebuilding of the Second Temple. If you notice in paragraph C on page 5, that the name of, in the name of the, when, of the list of leaders on the first wave of, under Cyrus, the name Mordechai appears. And in fact, according to tradition, it is the same Mordechai. Or Megillah and Tezayin and Beis, it is one and the same man. In fact, Mordechai, according to tradition, was a member of the Anshe Knesset HaGdoila. He was a member of the great assembly of those special individuals who led the Jews during this period. So even though we know very little about Mordechai from the story itself, it would seem, both from the similarity of the name and tradition, that he was a person who played a tremendous role. And putting this whole thing in its proper context, seeing that Ahasuerus is the one who stopped the building of the temple, seeing that Mordechai was one of the major Jewish leaders of the time, we have an insight then what Mordechai was doing in Shushan. Shushan was not a particularly Jewish city. Of course, Jews lived throughout the Persian Empire. Jews, when they were exiled, concentrated in this area here, Babylonia. You can see. This is where the main yishuv, the main settlement of Jews were. This is where the main yeshivas were. Shushan was here. It was in Elam. It was another country. Shushan was the capital of Elam. Either Ahasuerus or Cyrus before him made Shushan a major capital of the empire. But it was before that it was just a minor provincial capital. And the question is, what was Mordechai doing here? I mean, it really was not a major center of Jewry. But if we can see in the last paragraph on page 5, paragraph D, from the Medrash Yalkut Shimoni, Mordechai went down to Shushan so the Beis HaMikdash should be built in his time. In other words, seeing the resistance that was put in the way of the rebuilding of the temple, it was important for Mordechai to make his residence in the royal capital, to use his influence somehow to change the events, which he, as history bore out, did. But the Medrash sees Mordechai's move to Shushan as really part of this process of rebuilding the temple. On page 6, we see that Haman, who we know as the one, simply just in terms of the one who attempted to destroy the Jews, and the tables were turned, of course, and he was destroyed, was actually involved in this process as well. As the Yalkut explains in paragraph A, is in section 4, they came to build the Beis HaMikdash, and Haman and his son Shimshai, so the scribe, the sofer, stood up against them. So the building of the Beis HaMikdash should cease in their time. In other words, Haman was involved in the original writing of those letters that influenced Ahasuerus to stop the building of the temple. And it's in paragraph B, in describing who wrote the letter to Artaxerxes, Artaxasta, says it's Shimshai the scribe wrote the letter. Shimshai, according to tradition, was a son of Haman. So Haman's involvement does not just begin when he rose to his position of a viceroy, but really began much before. It's important now to pause that if we have from the sources that we've collected from till now,
have seen that Ahasuerus was a person who lived in this interim period. He was responsible for the stopping of the building of the Beis HaMikdash, was constantly concerned that the Jews should not rebuild. Mordechai was involved, on the other hand, in an attempt to rebuild against what would be his arch enemy, his nemesis, Haman. And all the events point to this time. We have to stop and ask ourselves the question, who was this Ahasuerus? Where did he come from? There's a, if he's in section 5, this is in paragraph A, the Targum Sheni, this is a midrashic Targum, it's more than just a translation, it's really a midrash on Megillas Esther, describes Ahasuerus as the son of Darius the Mede. Darius, who together with Cyrus, his son-in-law, was the conqueror of Babylon, had a son by the name of Ahasuerus. We know that that first Darius's father's name was Ahasuerus, a different Ahasuerus. And he named his son Ahasuerus. That son, Ahasuerus, according to the Midrash, was the Ahasuerus of the Purim story. And in fact, I'll read with you now, this is in paragraph B in section 5, this is the last paragraph here on page 6. This is a fascinating Midrash, and I've really cut out much of it, which does not pertain to this particular topic, even though it's worthwhile on your own to take a look at this. Rav stated that Vashti was a young girl at the time that the Persians and Medes invaded Babylon and sacked the royal palace. Now the question is, according to tradition, Vashti, who was the daughter of Belshazzar, came to be the wife of Ahasuerus. How did that happen? And the Midrash preserves this tradition. And she was a young girl. She was at the palace. The Persians and Medes invaded, start to slaughter everyone in sight. And once much of the slaughtering had subsided, and they were settling themselves in, and evidently she emerged from one of the rooms, hearing the whole tumult, and ran amongst the conquerors. And also you could see a little girl, the picture of a little girl running back and forth, or maybe she was more than just a little girl, she was maybe in her adolescence. In the confusion, she ran to the man sitting on the royal throne. In other words, she went to the royal throne, she saw someone who looked the part, and she thought it was her father. And she ran up to Darius, who had already settled himself on that throne. Darius had pity on her when he saw her, did not kill her as he was busy destroying the rest of the royal family of Babylon, and married her off to his son Ahasuerus. So this tradition preserves the events of what actually had occurred. One would sense then it would seem that Ahasuerus would have been a shoe-in for his position. If this is the case, well, Darius was his father. He was the conqueror. He's the son. And it would seem naturally that he received his position on the basis of inheritance. Yet it's the same Rav who preserved the tradition in the Medrash Yalkut Shimoni, about that Ahasuerus being the son of Darius, but yet he himself says on the verse Asher Molach, referring that Ahasuerus reigned. You know who Ahasuerus Asher Molach says Mahodu v'yad Kush. The word Molach, he interprets as he ruled on his own. He was an usurper. Rav said this implies that he took the position of power on his own. How is one to understand this? It would seem to be he's the next in line. And I would just like to touch upon right now, and we will go into great detail in subsequent lectures, on the theories of Dr. Chaim Chafetz. Dr. Chaim Chafetz is has dedicated many years of his life to struggling with the contradictions that we have from our traditional sources of the picture of the history of the era. And the picture that we have that was reconstructed from the Greek sources, which in many places is at odds with ours. Time right now doesn't allow me to give a full treatment of this, but I'd like to borrow a piece of what he says to understand that lends much light into these events. According to Greek, to the reconstruction of Persian history that was made by Greeks and Romans in the beginning of the first century of the Common Era, based on the writings of Greeks who lived in the third century before the Common Era, it would seem after the Persian Empire had come to a close, or while it was in the process of coming to a close. There were many kings that were called Artaxerxes. In fact, there were three. The understanding from the Greek sources is Artaxerxes is a proper name. That was the king's name. As we stated before, traditional sources have it that Artaxerxes is not a proper name, but a royal name, like Pharaoh. But there are three. And in the story of the rise to power of Artaxerxes II, we find a story very similar to the story we have in traditional sources. Artaxerxes II's real name, his proper name, was Achash, very similar to Ahasuerus. His father's name was Darius. He had a brother named Cyrus. Tradition has that Cyrus' relation to Ahasuerus was of a brother-in-law. And after the death of Darius, for 3 years, there was a civil war of Cyrus against Artaxerxes. He wasn't called Artaxerxes yet. He was still Achash. In fact, according to Greek sources, he got the name Artaxerxes after he came to the throne. One of the great Greek historians is a historian by the name of Xenophon. And in a work he wrote about from Cyrus's side of what happened in those 3 years. He's called, by the way, Cyrus the Younger to distinguish him from Cyrus the Great. According to the theories of Chaim Chafetz, this Cyrus the Younger is in fact the Cyrus the Koresh of who was recorded in Tanakh. This Cyrus brought 10,000 Greek mercenaries to help him against the war against Achash. But Achash was successful. Just killed Cyrus in battle. And Xenophon was one amongst the 10,000 that had to flee against the armies of the Persians not to be wiped out. And finally somehow made their way back to Greece. We know from traditional sources, and this is from the Seder Olam, that the Koresh, Cyrus that's recorded in Tanakh, reigned for 3 years. And the question then was, who was the true successor? And quite possibly in this light, we could understand the dynamics of this story. That although Daryovish, Darius the Mede, and Koresh were the joint conquerors of Babylon, and there already was a pact that they would take turns. The first Darius would be the king, the king of the empire. And as he was the private king of the Medes, but he would be the emperor. And then afterwards, Cyrus, his son-in-law, retaining the position of king of Persia, would be now the emperor of the Persian Empire, the Persian Mede Empire. And it would keep on switching. And that was the...
At least as recorded from the Midrashic sources and from the Talmud, was the pact that they made. Therefore, Darius was the first king. Afterwards came his son-in-law, Cyrus. And it was to remain in Cyrus's hands. It seems this was not an accord that agreed with Ahasuerus. And in the 3 years that Chazal and Tanakh, the Bible, accords to Koresh, Ahasuerus was working to undermine the reign of Koresh. And finally, after 3 years, he was successful. It was after those 3 years that he took himself, became the king. But even while in this interim period, while he was maneuvering for power, he was still the king of the Medes. And he was, in a sense, a joint king with Cyrus. Only after he won did he take upon himself the royal title of Artaxerxes. And perhaps then we could understand better what was meant originally, that in describing the undermining of the building of the temple, have on page 2, section 2, paragraph A, and in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, wrote they unto him an accusation in the days of Artaxerxes. Perhaps this is a reference then to the two stages of Ahasuerus' rise to power. Because originally, he was only Ahasuerus. Later on, he is called Artaxerxes. He becomes now the emperor. He has new powers. So he was referred to when he was a minor king, a person with power and a person to write to. But he's now referred to with even greater respect and written to in greater detail when he becomes Artaxerxes, the emperor. So here we have a case, actually, then the Greek history really sheds much light. Their version of the history sheds much on our version and what's missing from ours. Besides the motif of the struggle for the rebuilding of the temple, we have another motif, which is described in the Talmud and in the Midrashim. And that's the struggle for national revigoration. That the Jews themselves have to make themselves fit to be a people of the temple. And this is the quote we have on page 7, section 6, on the first paragraph. Why were the Jews of that generation condemned to destruction? Rav Shimon said, because they bowed down to the image Nebuchadnezzar had erected. There was still a residue. There was still the idolatry that destroyed the temple, because that was one of the, probably the main reason why the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. still had not been totally eradicated from the Jews, even though they were not actively idolaters, but there was a certain sense of tolerance or acquiescence. And in that light, we can understand why it was so important for Mordechai not to bow down to Haman, because it represented part of this process. For him to bow down would be turning the pages of history back again to the first temple era. He was part of that group, the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, that were involved in this national revigoration. He had to show, in essence, that the times have changed, that we are above all of this. And we see that the process as a whole created a tremendous change amongst Jewry. On page 8, this is the quote of Abba Bar Kahana, that was the removal of the ring that of Achashverosh to give to Haman had a greater effect than the words of the 48 prophets and the 7 prophetesses and the Vios that prophesied to the Jews. They weren't able to effect such a change in the Jewish character than this calamity of what seemed to be their destruction. And it brought on a whole movement of tshuva. And the Kimu v'Kivlu that's written at the end of the Megillah, which was this affirmation of accepting what simply would mean the reading of the Megillah, and the commemoration of Purim, is understood from the Gemara and Shabbos, means beyond that. And this is in paragraph E, that the Jews affirmed and accepted, they affirmed what they originally accepted, the pledge that they made on Har Sinai. So here we now understand that the whole story of Purim set the stage for the rebuilding of the Second Temple, because it made a change in the Jews themselves. They themselves were now fit to re-enter Eretz Yisrael and to have a Beis HaMikdash, which in essence lasted longer than the first Beis HaMikdash. Hand in hand with this process, we can now understand as the destruction of Amalek. We understand Haman is Agagi. He comes from Agog. The destruction of Haman, his sons, his followers, was as understood to be part of the process of destroying Amalek. Destroying Amalek is a necessary ingredient for the building of the Beis HaMikdash. You have on page 8 in paragraph 7, and on section 7, destruction of Amalek, in paragraph A, we find the destruction of Amalek comes before the building of the Beis HaMikdash. It was important for Shaul to destroy it would be the essence of Amalek. Because very few Amalekim lived after Shaul came and destroyed their empire, their capital city. They were just stragglers. That set the stage for the building of the first temple. During the interim, of course, there was new generations of Amalekim that came up. And this is understood as the importance then of the program against them before building the second Beis HaMikdash. And in fact, and this is according to Halacha, there's a question as where of the Megillus Esther should be included in Tanakh, in Kisvei HaKodesh. The reason it was included, because it was understood to be a necessary ingredient to preserve our struggle with Amalek. No one denies that it was important for the Megillus Esther to be written down as a document to preserve that history and to be read every Purim. The question is, should it be part of the collection of Tanakh? Is it part of Kisvei HaKodesh, the collection of holy works? The reason that it
it was finally decided that it should belong, was on the basis that there was an illusion in the original commandment to record the events that alluded as a hint that this event should also be included. And this is in section 7, paragraph B. This is the Gemara Megillah and Daf Zion, that there's an allusion from the redundancy of the phrases that the words Ba'Sefer alludes to the Sefer of the Megillah. In fact, the Megillah's Esther is to be written like a Sefer, and one is to read the Megillah's Esther from the Sefer is based on this, partially based on this allusion. So here we have another part of this general picture then. That the story of Purim, the destruction of Amalek, is not just part of our continuous struggle, but it's to be understood in the light this is part of the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. I would like now just to share with you in the next few moments, at least would be considered some of what we call extra Talmudic or extra Midrashic support, at least for the understanding that these events were recorded at the time they actually are stated to be recorded. One has to understand, and I'm only alluding to it now, and we'll be understanding greater detail in the following lectures, that the picture that we drew now of Ahasuerus and the dynamics of Purim and its place in history in rebuilding the temple is not the one that's understood by secular historians. In fact, they have great trouble of when to place the Megillah's Esther, because it does not neatly fit into at least their reconstruction of history. And because of their problems, there's a great body of scholars that maintain that it must have been written many years after these events. Because if it were written truly when, as it says, when it actually occurred, then all of Persian history would have to be rethought. Because Persian history, as I understand, just does not fit well with our view. One interesting point which seems to emphasize that the events that were recorded at the time they occurred is the striking recording of the picture of what Shushan was and the palace was. It would seem that only those who were there could actually record what it looked like. One has to understand that Alexander the Great destroyed Shushan. So in the Greek period, there was no Shushan to point to. All their memory must have been either, according to secular historians, a vague memory that happened many years after the fact, or people who lived saw Shushan. I'd like to just turn on the... But this is a tell. This is actually a mound. Shushan is a very, very old city. In fact, one of the oldest cities of antiquity. But they discovered the Shushan of the Persian period. This was in the late 1800s. I think it was 1874 they dug this up. And they found a very interesting phenomenon. Besides finding the remnants of the palace and the chotzer, the courtyards, which are described in so much great Bechatzar Ginas Bisan HaMelech, about the gardens and the courtyards, which they all found. They found also a very interesting piece of geography that I'd like to share with you. We find very often the term Shushan HaBira, Shushan the capital. We find also the term Ir Shushan, the city of Shushan. You can just notice, this is on page 8, section 8, this is in the Hebrew, and the bottom thing is it turns now to page 9. As you see, says in the center, the decree was given in Shushan HaBira, Shushan the palace. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but Ha'ir Shushan Nevoicha, the city of Shushan, was perplexed. It seems to be two places, Shushan HaBira and Ir Shushan. As if there's two sections of the city, the royal section and the city as a whole, the Ir Shushan. The archaeologists found, actually there were two sections of the city. They found the royal section and the regular section. And they were separated by a moat of water. And it's interesting, the Talmud, the Gemara, preserve the tradition of that moat. And you see on page 9, on paragraph B, and Mordechai passed. After Mordechai spoke to Esther about the impending tragedy, and he was to go amongst the Jews and proclaim the following days as fast days, so Shmuel said that this refers to Mordechai's passing through a moat. Because he had to pay, he went from Shushan HaBira to Ir Shushan, to the city of Shushan. And therefore he had to go through this moat. I don't see the moat in this picture. The Gleibnir says they actually did find the moat, which is interesting that even that tradition was preserved, which is indicative of a work that was written at the time that it occurred. Another interesting point, this is made by the historian of Isaac Halevi, is the last sentence of the Megillus Esther finishes off, actually it's the last section, it's the last chapter. Yosem HaMelech HaChashverosh Ma'asal Oretz V'Yayom, that he placed a tax on the land and the isles of the sea, which would indicate, by the way, that he had power over the isles of the sea. This is not a point. The isles of the sea are commonly understood to be understood the Greek isles. In this picture here, we have the picture. This is Darius, the builder of the Beis HaMikdash, not to be confused with Darius the Mede, but this is Darius who built the Beis HaMikdash. This was taken from the palace in Persepolis. If you just need the next one just for a second. This is Persepolis. This was the capital that Darius built. Alexander the Great destroyed it. This is what the remnants of that palace.
Where is that?
Persepolis is in southern Iran. And you just go back now. This is Darius, the builder of the temple. The one behind him is his son, Ahasuerus, or Xerxes. Who was this Xerxes in history? We will discuss later on. However, it is commonly understood that this is the Xerxes which is described by Herodotus as the one who lost the Greek Isles. He was the one who, in the Battle of Marathon, of Salamis, was defeated by the Greeks. We celebrate this every year with the Boston Marathon. He evidently was no position to put any taxes on the Greek Isles.
Would he be Xerxes III?
No, this man is
name was Xerxes. And Norm, in the commonly accepted history, this man who was the son of Darius, followed him in his throne and lost Greece. You know, we have always the problem, like, who lost Vietnam? He's the one who lost Greece. The Ahasuerus that's described here evidently would seem to have been very much in control of Greece. And it continues on, and all his greatness and all his great deeds and what Mordecai did are all recorded in the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia. This is... The question is, why was this included in the Megillus Esther 4? And it would just seem, and this is the argument of Isaac Halevi, that since it was written while the Jews were subject to the Persians, it was important that this piece be added for goodwill. If, as it's understood by many secular historians, that this was written many years afterwards, and really they claim in the time of the Maccabees, but it was written many years afterwards, after there no longer was a Persian Empire, there's really no reason to add these words in. In fact, if one reads the Megillus Esther, it's clear that after the story is finished, and the story is finished in chapter 9, in verse 19, on verse 20, we have, and really this is the, if you notice, this is on page 9, section 9, paragraph A, V'yichtav Mordechai esad dvorim ha'eila. Mordechai wrote these things. The Megillus Esther, the bulk of the Megillus Esther, is really the letter that Mordechai wrote to all the Jews. That's what the Megillah is. Afterwards, it says that he wrote it. He wanted to make certain changes in what had become a spontaneous observance, because they started observing it as a Yom Tov, a day of cessation of work, and which would come a problem of adding another Yom Tov. There's a Baal Tosef, we can't add new things to the Torah. And he changed it from being a day of work to really a day of giving Shalach Monas. It became a Matanas Levyonim. It became a day of gift-giving and charity. And it goes on, this is, and the Megillah goes on now, after describing where he sent the letter. It goes on verse 23, is now the Jews accepted upon themselves to do all that had been written. It seems from the Gemara, this is a point Rav Isaac Halevi makes, that this sentence, the 23rd, until the end of the Megillah, which is some 10, it would just be some 12, 13 verses, were written much later by the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. Men of the Great Assembly were the ones who fixed, this we're going to detail in the next lecture, about, they fixed the Kisvei HaKodesh. They were the ones who canonized, let's see, the books of the Bible, the Sifrei Tanakh. They wrote the very last section of Megillus Esther. And it would seem, of course, even the last sentences, which are written for goodwill, were written during that time, because the Anshei Knesset HaGedola flourished in the Persian period. By the time the Greeks came on the scene, the Anshei Knesset HaGedola already finished all their work. In fact, the last historic work that we have, this is the Book of Nehemiah, The last recordings are some 2 years before Alexander the Great comes and conquers the empire. So it just would seem, from the reading itself, we're dealing with a work that was written at the time, a very accurate work. What we read every year is basically Mordecai's letter. And with that, I would like to conclude with a fascinating theory of Isaac Halevi, why Hashem's name is not mentioned in the Megillah. Of course, most of you are familiar with the words of the Vilna Gaon, that the reason Hashem's name is not mentioned is because the whole miracle is a nes nister, is a hidden miracle. God's hand is not obvious in the story of Purim. It's behind the scenes. One has to look to see the hand of Hashem. Therefore, Hashem's name is not written. It's the hidden hand of Hashem. Rav Isaac Halevi wants to offer another, perhaps not contradictory, but another explanation. Since the Megillah was written as a letter, there was a great concern. Letters should not have Hashem's name on them. And I'd like this on page 9, the last paragraph, paragraph B. And we'll read this on the 3rd of Tishrei. This is taken from, this is a quote from Megillas Tainus. The Gemara in Roshon and Yilches Amud Beis quotes Megillas Tainus. Megillas Tainus was a work which recorded minor festivals and was written at the end of the Second Temple period, circa around the year 50 of the Common Era. And it recorded all those events that had occurred in what would have been recent history, that they proclaim minor festivals, that one should not fast sometimes, that one shouldn't not only not fast, one was not allowed to give a eulogy that day to take away from the festivity of the day. One of the days that's recorded is the 3rd of Tishrei. This is in chapter 7 of the Megillas Tainus. The 3rd of Tishrei, the name of Hashem was removed from documents. There was enough, this event seemed to warrant enough importance that there was a festival, a minor festival declared. And it continues on, when the Greeks were in power, they decreed that the name of Hashem was not allowed to be mentioned, even verbally, by the Jews. This harkens back to the Hanukkah story. When the Chashmonaim were victorious, they instituted that Hashem's name be mentioned even in documents, as they went overboard. So in every letter that was written, or official document that was made, a legal document that was made, the Hashem's name was made, and they gave it. For instance, they would write such and such a date in the reign of Yochanan Kohen Gadol, L'Kael Elyon, the Most High God. So the word Kael was written in every document. When the sages became aware of this practice, they said, tomorrow the person will pay his debt, it's just a legal document, and the document with Hashem's name will be lying in the garbage, and they'll just throw it out. And because of that concern, they had to work, perhaps behind the scenes, because Yochanan Kohen Gadol eventually became a Sadducee, and it was very difficult to work with him. And when they were able to change the mode of document writing, they declare this to be a holiday. That day, this is the day that they managed to annul this practice, made into a minor holiday. So the third, in the Second Temple period, on the 3rd of Tishrei, and even the day before it, was a day that the fasting was not allowed. If there was such a concern that Hashem's name should not be written, then of course the Megillah, which was originally written as private correspondence of Mordechai to all the Jews, would not have Hashem's name. The Megillas Esther merely preserves the original document. And that's why Hashem's name is not in the Megillas Esther. Okay, are there any questions?
Any understanding as to why there's an issue of having some influence on women, destruction of people that all require to do?
It would seem that their very existence has a negative impact on the Jewish world. The fact that they flourish, the fact that their mores, their values impact on us, practically indirectly because of their impact on the greater world and eventually to us. It's important that their role be diminished. Yeah, well, that actually, what they refer to the Amalek being destroyed as importance for prerequisite actually happened in the reign of Shaul. Historically, it seems that there were still remnants of Amalek left during the time of David HaMelech, during even the time of Chizkiyahu HaMelech, which they were wiped out totally from would be the south of Eretz Yisrael and Edom. That group that were concerned of now were those that came out from Agag, who eventually became a major, a major group. Okay.
I guess you left the Sanhedrin at that time. What happened to those two?
I hate to say they lived happily ever after. Mordechai, it seems, we find again back in Eretz Yisrael a later time. If one has to be, we'll touch upon this next time about Ezra and the Anshe Knesset HaGdola. Esther remains a very tragic figure in terms of her own personal sacrifice, but it does seem that the rebuilding of the Beis Hamikdash under Darius II had to do, in no small measure, with the influence they still exerted. So even though Ahasuerus was no longer the king, she still exerted some positive influence. Bunny?
I'm not sure. I might have missed it. Did you explain Rabbi Abba's commentary about
Ahasuerus at Sabah? Yeah. It's just that the taking out the ring, referring to the... now all the power that Haman had and the power he exercised in putting this decree that the Jews would all be destroyed created a whole movement of tshuva. That's because they were going to be destroyed. This is the fasting in Shushan, and every place where the letter was received from Haman, there must have been similar events that occurred. And those created this national reawakening.
You mentioned how the Beis Hamikdash was starved and then stopped. Does that mean there was a large influx of Jews earlier on before Ahasuerus' reign?
There were some 42,000 Jews that came up in the reign of Cyrus of Koresh with Zerubbabel. They came to start to rebuild the temple. We discussed it the last time. They built the foundations of the temple. They didn't get that far, and then they were stopped. What happened to those people? Did they stay? Did they go back? Is not clear. But something which is very theoretical, which touches upon this role of Amalek, so to speak, and the rebuilding of the Beis Hamikdash. There happens to be another struggle that's involved here. And this touches the theories of Dr. Chaim Chafetz. After the reign of the second Darius, the religion of Persia changed. It's changed to Zoroastrianism. Zoroaster, who seems to have been, it's not clear where he came from, but created a religion that was very close to monotheism. It eventually came to a form of a dualism, that there was a god of the positive, god of the negative. It seems from historical sources that originally, the original form of Zoroastrianism was really one where it was mainly a monotheistic religion and the power of evil was subservient, so to speak. Through the years it changed. But it was very close. It was much closer to monotheism than the religion beforehand, which was really just gross paganism. Darius was a follower of Zoroastrianism. His father's name was Hystaspas, which is also a name of one of the leaders of Zoroastrianism. So again, it's theory. If it's the same man, but this is again, I'm just saying the theories of Chaim Chavetz, which would point to be a certain similarity here. So here we find a struggle between the old religion and Persia that is being macabre, is committing itself to a religion which is very close to Judaism. The old religion was called Mithraism. Mithra was a name of the was one of major gods of this, similar to Baal of the Canaanite religion. And it was a very sensuous religion, and he had there was the belief in this consort, which would be similar to Ashtaros in the Canaanite religion. Dr. Chaim Chavetz brings an interesting source that points out that even though originally in Mithraism there were just two major gods, there's Mithra and the consort Anahita, later on there were added two other gods, which the names sound very similar to Haman and Hamdasa. And he points out, and this is his theory, and again, that Haman actually was a leader and a priest of the Mithra rite. He wanted to bring back Mithraism after it had fallen basically into disuse or into a minor role, because Darius and Cyrus, the conquerors of Babylon, were actually followers of Zoroaster. And then when I can understand the battle of Ahasuerus against Cyrus was a battle, was not just a political battle, but it was a religious battle as well. Haman, the one who wanted to destroy the Beis HaMikdash, to stop its rebuilding, wanted to destroy the Jews, became eventually one of their gods. Hamdasa, he's always a Haman ben Hamdasa. Hamdasa was a personage in that era, was well known, was also one of the leading figures. That's why Haman eventually became deified. So according to his theory then, the destruction of Haman, of Amalek, represented just far more than just what we call like Xeris HaKosov, just fulfilling the mitzvah of destroying Amalek, but really changed the whole picture of the era. When Ahasuerus died, and according to the thing, if Ahasuerus is this Ochosh, he was killed. After he died, there was an interim period before Darius came to the throne. And there was a religious leader who became the king for 7 months, who had a name which was very similar to Hamdasa. He rose to power on Tisha B'Av. He was killed on Purim, Yud Dalet Adar, and this is what Darius records. In the records of Darius that we have in Persepolis, we have about his being killed on the 14th of Adar. After his death, Darius comes to the throne, introduces Zoroastrianism. So here we have a totally different struggle. The Greeks preserved a Persian festival of the 14th of Adar as a great time of festivities, and they understood it because this refers to the fall of this priest and the introduction of Zoroastrianism. Dr. Chaffetz maintains that they confuse this with Purim. It happened a year later, 2 years later. Around the same time. So really, again, one has to just go through thinking how much is really theory and fact, but it makes fascinating reading. So really parallel to what our struggle with Amalek, in our struggle to rebuild the temple and to recommit ourselves as Jews, we have this other struggle which is coming on a universal stage of Jewish values, of monotheism, coming to the fore against the ancient paganism. And it could be for, and then we can understand then Mordechai and Esther's influence in a much greater sense of how it may have had on Darius and implementing the overthrow of paganism in Persian Empire. Yeah, just one. Yeah. According to this Midrash, sure. The Mead, right?
Very low. No. I think I was
very fast
stable mass
with
my father.
Yeah. The it would seem, even that it's really not a thing, that really he had a, under the Babylonians, the Persians were subservient. And he had, stable master is a position of a minor petty official, which he may have been under the Babylonians. He only became what he became once they came into power. One could read this, of course, that Gemara, and say that he was just simply a commoner. I'm just trying to put it in the light of the other Medrash, that it shouldn't be a contradiction. And actually, perhaps he was not a commoner, actually came from royalty, but he got that position not because he naturally would inherit the throne, but he pushed his way to power. Yeah. The Gemara asked the Kasha. Actually, in the time of the Second Temple period, we'll stop now just for general. We can come afterwards, but we'll stop for the general questions. In the Second Temple period, the third of Tishrei, Tzom Gedal was also a minor festival, because all those fast days, which began to be celebrated in the Golis, turned into minor festivals when the temple was rebuilt, viewing that all those events were really preparatory events for the building of the temple. But since it's mentioned in Tanakh, that only that day was a day of prohibition of fasting. The day before, one could have fasted. The third of Tishrei that was added later on meant not only that day one was not allowed to fast, but the day before as well. So declaring that as the holiday also brought with it, the day before also became a day that one was not allowed to fast, and that's why the third of Tishrei, even though one was not allowed to fast beforehand, there was a greater emphasis on that day, and which meant that not only don't you fast that day, but the day before also you don't fast.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.